This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Hawk can't join us this evening, but today we have Dr. Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good. Should we tell them why we don't have Dr. Hawk?
Well,
all right. We're going to confess. Okay.
Are we going to blame Dr. Greger again?
No. No. For the last 2 weeks, we made beautiful recordings. Jen was fabulous. I was solid, and I screwed up the technology both times, people. Both times I lost the recording. So Jen would have every right to fire me. And so instead I said, listen, why don't you just take today off while we redo this, and we'll see you next week. So that's all. That's what actually happened. So we'll try to recover some of the answers to some of those questions.
Yeah. And to be honest, Dr. Lyle, 2 out of 234 ain't bad.
Yeah.
And so speaking of statistics,
yeah. Yeah.
you have some comments to make about current statistics. Is that right?
Yeah. Actually, one thing, I've had some people write to me a few times about how, you know, what happened to our COVID discussions. And I think what happened to us was we sort of got adrift and away from it, after we saw the pattern and became increasingly less interested until the picture got clearer. I think the picture is quite a bit clearer now. I think it's going to get a lot clearer here in the next few weeks. But I'm seeing an interesting thing. It's the mirror image of something that happened early in last March, as COVID was headed our way. I had a couple of two or three, as I recall, conversations with some bright people that said they had heard me talk and said that. That they didn't really see how on earth that we were going to wind up with the 40,000 or 50,000 or 60,000 deaths that I thought we were going to see in April. And I said, oh, yes, it is. It's coming and it's going to happen. And so it was such a change from where it is that we were at that point that they couldn't quite fathom it. And even though I have a friend of mine who was like kind of pleading with me, like, no, really? I mean, you really think that's going to happen? It's like, yes, it's absolutely going to happen. It's a certainty. We just don't know what it's going to look like exactly. But trust me, there's going to be tens of thousands of fatalities in April. And there were. And similarly, I'm seeing the mirror image of that now. And the mirror image is that this thing is just going to go on forever, and that we have to keep locking down. We have some intelligent people saying this. God knows, I think Bill Gates is chirping up this way, and the head of the Fed in St. Louis or some place is saying similar. It's extraordinary to me that this is what we're hearing, because not to say that I'm smarter than these people, because I don't think I am. It's a little bizarre that that's their perspective, and let me explain why. The truth of the matter is we now have a fairly decent handle on the mathematics of this first round of COVID, which by all accounts should be the worst that we'll ever see it. And all we have to do is we have to look at a place. We had a beautiful experiment that took place in spite of a lot of people's consternation and objections. A beautiful experiment was took place in Sweden, where we had one tough old Swede that basically said, we're going to do it this way. We're going to keep it open and we're going to let this thing go through with reasonable intelligence on the part of the population without locking down, without worrying about masks or anything else. And what took place was they've had about 5,700 fatalities out of their 10 million people. And as a result of that, they're done. If you look at the Swedish curve, it's over in Sweden. And what they did effectively was they took the Band-Aid off quickly. Now, other places that have locked down, as Jen has a phrase for this, I guess it comes out of political science, it's called mission creep. So what happened is we got mission creep in the United States, where it went from let's lock down to flatten the curve so we don't overwhelm our health system, all the way to we have to lock down to try to stop the virus from spreading and maybe delay it all until sometime we get a vaccine. That is incredible mission creep. But that's exactly what happened. And it happened all over the political spectrum. This wasn't a singular dimension. It's not a Republican or Democrat issue. It's a very, although there's certainly differences there from different perspectives there across the board. But the basic thing that happened was mission creep. And what we've now see is when you take out your pocket calculator and you say, okay, well, if you've got 5,700 deaths per 10 million, and you take a look at Italy, and Italy has about 60 million people or so, and you multiply 5,700 deaths that happened free form in Sweden, and then you multiply that times the 65 million people in Italy, you get about 35,000, which is exactly how many people died in Italy before it all stopped. Okay? Then you do the same thing in Spain, which is a smaller country, a little bit smaller than Italy, and they've got fewer fatalities. I can't remember what they wound up with, 25,000 or so, i.e. the same ratio. Then you go to Great Britain, and they're a little worse, but it's in the same, easily within the same order of magnitude. In other words, it's within a 1 to 1.5 multiplication ratio of this. In other words, everywhere you look, this is what you're going to see. So what the virus does is it... because it's a novel virus and we don't have an existing immune to it, or at least a lot of people don't. So it races its way through the population, it takes its pound of flesh, and you can try to slow it down, but it's going to get there in all probability. Places that have done a masterful job of sequestering themselves at great expense, a place like Iceland, we would have anticipated at this rate that Iceland would have had... Let me see, with 350,000 people, I think we would have expected somewhere in the neighborhood of 180 fatalities, more or less, and they have 10, and that's because they literally were able to lock down an island. So at great expense, they did this. However, they're not done. So there they sit, defending that strategy at great expense, hoping that there will be either better treatments in the long run or a vaccine that could help, et cetera. But essentially, they have a debt to Corona on the order of 150 or so fatalities. Now, the United States, if we take out our pocket calculator, for all of the hand-wringing and consternation and masks and locking down and shutting the restaurants and shutting the schools and everything else under the sun, where are we today? Well, take out your pocket calculator and multiply 5,700 deaths per 10 million, multiply that by 32.5 because there's 325 million people in the United States. And lo and behold, you're going to wind up somewhere in the neighborhood of 175 fatalities. And guess what? That's almost where we are. So I heard a news report, I think Niles Ferguson or whoever this guy was, that started the whole alarm at Imperial College in London, saying that by locking down, Britain had saved 500,000 lives. This is total BS, people. Total BS. If that were true, then Sweden, that did not lock down and had 5,700 fatalities out of 10 million, which is about one-sixth the size of Great Britain,
If you do that multiplication, you would expect about 35,000 deaths in Great Britain. They have over 45,000. So where the hell is the net benefit? And the answer is, it's not to be found. That's a lie. That's a total political commentary to a completely confused populace from a big-time a scholar who's truly has egg all over his face and is now going to defend an extraordinarily expensive experiment in trying to control an epidemic that failed. Okay, so the bottom line is that my personal sort of interest in this is watching people now, including those same intelligent people that I was talking to 4 months ago, telling them that this is inevitable, that you're going to have this crisis. And now they're not thinking it's going to end. And it's like, well, now that's really interesting. What exactly are you thinking? Are you thinking that you're going to see another 175,000 fatalities in the next 4 months in the United States? That doesn't make any sense at all. That would make the United States' situation entirely different than what you saw in Sweden, in England, in Spain, in France, and in Italy. In other words, it would be utterly inconsistent with this. So the answer, folks, is we're about done. Okay? And strangely enough, you have people sort of not grasping this and the news media not reporting that this is obviously where this is headed. And obviously we had a second wave of sorts here in the southern United States, because the United States is a much larger landmass than an individual country in Europe. And so in the same way that it had to march its way through different places in Europe at different times, it had to march its way through the United States in different places at different times. And it's now about done. So unless the United States has an extraordinarily more vulnerable population, which it does not, than Sweden, for example. In other words, our age of our population is about the same as Sweden's, and we eat similarly rich crap with Sweden, and we probably have similar obesity to Sweden, and we probably have similar smoking rates to Sweden. So we were not really going to expect that the United States fatality ratios are going to be significantly different than Sweden's. So we should be expecting somewhere in the neighborhood of 175,000 to 200,000 deaths at this point, now that we have the data in. And that's what it's going to be. So relax. Everybody chill out. We're down to the last 60 days of the coronavirus being a substantial public health threat in the United States, at least for the time being. And so, hey, I'm looking forward, as I watch the numbers quietly start to fall on the final part of the curve, to life getting normal. Now, the fact that people are not anticipating this well at all is kind of, we're seeing human nature once again. Once it gets used to something, it can't imagine that there's going to be a change. And so there's going to be a significant change. It's November and December aren't going to look anything like July and August. And so, but it may take a while for this to get absorbed. And so I actually think that come about the first of the year, all the little penguins are going to start to jump in the water when they find out that the water's safe. So I think that your country, Nathan, and everybody, is going to look an awful lot like the country that we had last February come this coming February. So I think there'll obviously be some tenacious hold on some changes as a result of the hyper-conscientiousness of a lot of individuals. But essentially, the America that you know and the marketplace that you know will return in full force rather soon.
Wonderful. Well, that certainly relaxes me. I know that I've been looking at the CDC's provisional death counts, mm-hmm. and that seems to support exactly what you're saying. They have a big graph mm-hmm. that goes all the way up, and then it's coming down, and we're basically at the very tail end of it.
Right.
And so it's I'm going to post that to the Beat Your Genes, fans of the Beat Your Genes Facebook group, for those of people who are interested.
Yeah.
But appreciate it, Dr. Lyle. This
good.
It's always nice to hear a voice of reason.
Yeah.
In such a chaotic,
data-driven, sure. Well,
political-driven.
To be fair, this was, you know, two or three times as bad as I thought it was going to be. Actually, a a very thoughtful commentary from a doctor in Sweden, basically says that that he believes he's thinking, from what he can tell, that in order to get herd immunity, you probably have to have about half of the people infected. So he believes that probably about half of Sweden was infected, about 5 million cases. And then if you take those 5 million cases and you put 5,700 fatalities over it, you're more or less boiling down to an infection fatality ratio of 0.12, which is down in the flu-like numbers. So people might back up and horrified, because that's language we're not supposed to use to call this flu-like numbers, but it looks like they are. So the fact that we had a obviously much worse than a normal flu season. Normal flu season in the United States might take 50 or 60,000 fatalities, and this one's going to take maybe three times that. But that's because it's the first time through. Okay, so the first time through, by the time it washes through the population and you get effective a substantial amount of herd immunity, next year you're probably talking about 100 million to 150 million infections have taken place in the United States. They've actually tested and counted millions, but we know that far more than that have escaped our notice, obviously, because in the time when it was raging through the system, we had almost no testing at all. So if we've actually tested 5 or 6 million people positive, we know, just as this Swedish doc is explaining, that as it works its way through the population to the point where basically nobody's getting infected and nobody's dying at the end of the end of the curve, that means it didn't just go away and hide with a little time clock on it. It started banging into immunity all over the place as it tried to jump from person to person, and it found a brick wall. That's how these things work. So therefore we begin, or we don't really begin, because this thing doesn't look like it has a season like the flu, because it's not the flu. But the point is that there's nothing magical coming at us in November, December, January, February that is like the flu, that this thing is going to rain on top of us. Instead, what we're seeing is that it worked its way through the population. It will probably continue percolating. In other words, it probably won't be eliminated. It will probably percolate slowly and become a minor health threat, you know, in the United States. You know, depending upon, for example, how long the immunity lasts in an individual, it could be that immunity doesn't last forever, so you may get a slight infection and not know it, which is the vast majority of cases are apparently essentially asymptomatic. And therefore, you may carry some immunity for, what, a year or two? But that means that the coronavirus that we know may perk around and take, as the flu does, you know, 10,000, 20,000, 30,000, or even 40,000 or 50,000 deaths a year, mostly from the elderly and sick, just like the flu does. So I think that this is a very flu-like process and flu-like deadliness, except that in this particular case, we had a population, a world population, that had no immunity to it. So the first year is the year that you get hit really hard, and the next year is a very different story. So I think that the gloom and doom that we have a new world order, that everybody's going to wear masks and sit behind their TV screen and never congregate anywhere and never go to a ball game, I think is just absolutely ludicrous. And I think the absurdity of that projection will become blatantly obvious in 8 weeks. So I look forward to watching the end of this catastrophe in the next 2 months as we see the final curves of the final outposts of the United States vulnerability fade into the background.
Wow, thank you, Dr. Lau. So the case, or the infection fatality rate, seems to be what, anywhere from 0.15 or so, all the way, could potentially be 0.4, I think, is the measurement I read in the CDC.
Yeah, I don't think that's true. In other words, I think the CDC is vastly underestimating how widespread the infection is. And the reason why I believe so, Nathan, is because, for example, in a place like Sweden, where it has been allowed to go through the population, it has not been stopped, okay? It stopped itself. So there'd be no reason for this to stop itself until you have herd immunity. And so so clearly it wound up – so in order to get herd immunity, we had to get the reproduction ratios on these things. You have to get half the population exposed.
to get herd immunity. So as a result, that means that they had 5 million infections in Sweden. They've had 5,700 deaths. That's looking more, that those estimations start looking like 0.12. So I think the CDC's estimations are, I think we're back to John Ioannidis. I think he had it right all along. So it's just that the first year, obviously, you know, blows your hair back is what happened. So, but I think the wild ride is about over.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, so 0.12%, whereas Dr. Lau, you know, you've had a two episode out of 234 episode mm-hmm. failure rate.
Yeah.
So you have a 0.85%. So you've got a worse failure rate at recording than COVID has.
All right. Fair enough. All right. Let's go on to something new.
Okay. Our next question. Dear doctors, there's a question about war. I'm fascinated about how humans can band together in tribes and kill each other. They also will battle each other while having hospitals right there to treat the wounded. I can understand fighting over resources, but these days it seems to be more over ideologies than that. Do you have any evolutionary insight into this? Couldn't this potentially be detrimental to gene and species survival?
Yes, there's a lot of insight on this, and so let's backtrack to the... Well, first of all, don't be so sure that people are going to war over ideology. So everywhere that you turn, they were after resources. So the Middle East has been an incredible hotbed because there's a bunch of oil over there. So tensions are very high greedy leadership in different places is always looking over at the next guy to see what they can take. Okay, the huge conflict in the Middle East right now has to do certainly one of the great conflicts has to do with Israel and the Gaza Strip, and they took our land and et cetera, et cetera. So this is those are resources, and so the ideology is likely to be probably serve a couple of functions. It's a justification function to enrage a group of males so that they will go to war. However, there at the other end of it, there isn't just ideological victory. There is resources that are also associated with this. Now, the fact that you could trip a couple of levers and get a war produced out of seemingly, you might not be able to detect the original resource problem. The original resource problem typically in a hunter-gatherer tribal warfare was somebody's theoretical stolen pig, okay? So some pig got loose, somebody else got it, they slaughtered it and they ate it, and then it turned out it was my pig, not your pig. And now we have a fist fight over it. And now that I lost the fist fight and I'm pissed off, in fact, it might have been worse than a fist fight. Maybe you killed me. Now my brother's going to come kill you. Okay? So now, in other words, an original resource dispute fuels a cycle of violence that then you may not remember what the original resource dispute was about, because it actually then became about status. And status is a very significant resource. Also, the original adaptation was basically to get women. So this has been beautifully outlined by Tubby and Cosmides, the resident geniuses of the world of psychology, and they worked this out quite a long time ago. So people that have heard my talk getting along without going along in that talk, I talk about how that you know, it's all about the eggs, that women are the cause of all war. Okay, and they are, okay, and so they don't want to be. Women have no warfare chip. They don't have any warfare adaptation. Warfare is strictly an adaptation in men, and it's about women, and there are certain conditions under which this could have evolved and, in fact, did evolve. So in our species, as well as in chimpanzees, there are obviously other species that will go to war. But humans and chimps are the only big ones that we know of. The other ones are things like ants and bees and wasps and stuff like that. So, but in the war adaptation side of humans evolved in order to statistically increase reproductive success. And so that meant that there were a certain set of conditions that made it likely for the warfare instinct effectively to be activated. That would have been, they would have had to have situations where they're what Chubby and Cosmides call a veil of ignorance about who's going to die. So if there's 10 guys going to war against eight guys on the other side of the river, and incidentally, one of the conditions is the belief that we will win, and a huge part of that has to do with whether or not we think we've got bigger numbers than they do, or if we don't have bigger numbers, we are sufficiently more talented. We're bigger and stronger. We're younger. We may have a device that they don't have. We've got a plan that they won't see coming, and they've got some very good-looking women over there that we want to get to, and we can't manage to trade for them. So that, but you have to have an ignorance as you go into the warfare that, number one, that you don't know who's going to die, if anybody, so you certainly don't know that you're going to die. And second of all, you have to believe that you're going to be victorious. And so there should be instincts for defection and desertion if things start going bad, which of course there would be. This is well known in the military. And it should also be the case that people in the group should be paying attention to who takes the risks, and the rewards should be essentially honored and meted out relative to the risks, not just the risks, but also the contributions that people made during the fight. These are all part of a cohesive system, an adaptive system for what clearly evolved in humans, where men banding together in warlike bands would have been more successful at reproducing their genes than men who did not. And so the men who did that and had that as a proclivity for their psychology out-reproduced the men the proto-humans that did not develop that tendency as significantly. So we are instinctually war. We're an instinctually warlike species. Those instincts are almost exclusively activated in men. So it's a little strange even now. It makes sense for women to be, quote, serving in the military in certain capacities, but the rage of battle and the desire to kill the other guy, this is going to make more sense to the psychology of a male. And they're looking and angling to get reproductively relevant resources to this day. So they want fancy stripes on them. They want medals of honor. This is all to grandstand to females in order to increase your likelihood of mating success. You know, this is the great pride, the beautiful uniforms. This is all done to essentially trade out the increase a young man's likelihood of mating success early in life as they battle the cost benefit against losing the whole goddamn thing. Okay, so that's the same cost benefit, complicated cost benefit that nature had to run through umpteen generations of proto-humans as they essentially slowly evolved the cohesive band, probably complete with an earlier part of the question, which was about, quote, ideology. Well, don't think that something that adds to the warlike cohesiveness of a group of men is the fact that our ideology is better than your ideology, and you're in fact kind of shitty people, and therefore you deserve to be killed. Okay, so that, you know, that instinct that Tubby and Cosmides don't talk about, but I'm sure has been talked about by other people, is undoubtedly also an instinctual part of the system. So yeah, that's you should be amazed. It's a bizarre adaptation. You won't see the horses do it. You won't see the cows do it. You won't even see the wolves do it. You won't see the lions do it. but you'll see humans do it. And you're not going to see all of them do it. You're going to see typically throughout the course of history, the males do it. And the reason why is that it is an adaptive, it's an instinct inside the human male. We feel that instinct when we're in heavy competition in sports. You feel the same kind of thing. In fact, the person who doesn't back down from the greatest high pressure challenges and wants to, you know, essentially take the big responsibility of the big risks, the guy that wants to take the big shot, we call that a killer instinct. Okay? And it is revered in the sports world. So Michael Jordan and Kobe Bryant are two of the most revered personalities in that game precisely because of their killer instinct. LeBron James has been criticized throughout his career for not having a killer instinct, for his willingness to be deferential and to essentially not, quote, take over the game at the end. Now, I think he actually does a brilliant job. I think he's a I think LeBron James has just a little bit less, I'll take all the risks myself, and if I win, I get all the rewards, and if I lose, I'm willing to be the GOAT, and I don't give a damn. I think he has a little bit less of that intense gambler mentality that both Michael and Kobe had, and as a result, I don't think he makes any worse decisions. I think he makes outstanding decisions in those situations. But we do see a personality difference, okay? And it is he's got a little less of that vicious, selfish me first than either of those guys had, i.e., the killer instinct.
Wonderful.
All right.
Wow. Yeah, I really appreciated, Dr. Lau, the beginning of the podcast where you explained how sports are essentially a proxy for war, so we don't have to go and kill each other.
Sure. Yes, it's a however, that doesn't mean we don't have big armies and a lot of international intrigue all the time, because we do. Because the same instincts are still bubbling around in the leaders of the world.
Mm-hmm. And we have those war games too.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Our next question. Why are we more inclined to have high expectations even when they make us fall into ego trap, while we don't like to have lower expectations even if they might help us? Is this due to social, cultural messaging or upbringing or something else the cause?
No, it's not sociocultural. These are instincts. And what's happening is that think of yourself being, quote, bored in a relationship or bored with a job, okay? Or just bored sitting around with, quote, nothing to do. What that means is that you are intuitively aware that you are not optimally using your time and energy in order to improve your situation with respect to survival and reproduction. So boredom is the handsome dude that's bent on casual mating strategy swaggers into a bar and there aren't enough hot women in there, and so he feels, quote, bored. Okay, that's a feedback system that says what we are doing right now is not advancing our interests, our genetic interests, ultimately, obviously. So so in the same way, low expectations are you can't the expectations that you have and the goals that you seek are not something that you can choose. In fact, you do not choose them. What happens is that they occur to you. So if you say to yourself, "No, well, I chose to buy that house," I don't know who you is, but what's actually going on inside that nervous system is that deep algorithms are at work here, trying to figure out whether that's the best use of your finances and time and energy in pursuing that particular goal. And that goal arrives in consciousness, so you become aware of it, and there's an integrated set of actions in order to pursue it. And what a goal is it's a hypothesized state of the organism that is different than the one that's in now. And there's a sequence of operations, a sequence of behaviors that are going to be required in order for you to change your circumstances from where you are now to where it is that the goal, you know, would have you get to. Now, you might say, well, if we set those goals really high, you know, if we set, quote, high expectations, then this is going to potentially intimidate us into the ego trap. Whereas low expectations, if we keep them low, we will not be in the ego trap. This is true. The ego trap is a particular point. It's a particular motivational instinct that gets activated under very, very tightly constrained conditions. Those conditions are that I have a goal. So part of the information processing systems of my brain believe that I could achieve this. Now, not only did they, those circuits are coming up with the probability that we might be able to achieve this. They're also, it's also true that other people who are aware of our abilities, they too believe that we could achieve this. So the problem is that even though the goal is worthy and we feel an excitement about what it would be like to have achieved the goal because we can compute the survival and reproductive benefits that would result from this, i.e., getting into medical school, or i.e., getting into a surgical residency, or, you know, opening my art gallery with my paintings and being a big success in New York. That whatever that goal is, the reason why the individual is pursuing it at all is because they believe that it's going to improve circumstances enough to be worth the time and energy. Now, it's going to be the case that in order to generate excitement, that change of circumstances is going to need to be significant. Okay, so the only thing that's going to be exciting, an exciting goal, an exciting partner, an exciting job opportunity, an exciting entrepreneurial activity, an exciting vacation, anything that's going to be exciting is going to be something that is going to move you from the state you're in now to a state where you believe the survival and reproductive circumstances are going to improve substantially relative to the cost of getting it. So you could be excited about a sale at Macy's on sweaters because the truth is you look at them and you're like, yeah, those were $50 sweaters. Now they're going to be $25. It generates some excitement. If you plan on buying four of them and saving $100, and $100 is a substantial savings for you. So you can't choose what you're excited about, and you can't choose your goals. Your goals wind up emanating from deep algorithms that basically tell you this is the most efficient use of your time and energy. Now, the excitement that drives those things, the excitement that goes along with the realization of a goal, a realization of a possibility that you might be able to achieve something, that comes along with the possibility. Obviously, if it's a prize situation that represents a substantial upgrade about from your circumstances to the new circumstances, you can better believe that there are competitive pressures. So if you are all excited, for example, about some deal on a flipper house that you think you're going to get a great deal on, your excitement is tempered and driven alongside your anxiety that somebody else is going to get it. Okay, you recognize that this is an excellent opportunity, and therefore there's tension in your system, and there's focus, and there's an urgency. You meet a new mate. That mate seems very, quote, exciting, which means that you feel like you're getting a great genetic deal if you're able to secure this. You feel an urgency and excitement about the competitive problem that someone else may get there first and derail your great deal. Now, so what I'm saying is that excitement is the signal that that a potential change would be very good. That's, quote, high expectations. Okay. Now, the truth is high expectations come with an intimidating other side. And the intimidating other side is we may try very hard and we may fail. Now, oftentimes that doesn't create the ego trap. So bidding on that junker house that you're so sure is going to be a killer deal, you may not have a feeling of, oh no, I'm not even going to try to bid because if I, you know, people think that I'm a sharp real estate person, and then if I don't get it, I'm going to look bad. that you may not have any kind of bizarre ego trap set up there that is going to stop you from doing anything other than pursuing that goal vigorously behind your excitement and urgency. However, there are circumstances where the goal that we seek is going to involve a performance that's going to be observed or cataloged, and whether we succeeded or failed is going to be recorded in somebody's head, if only our internal audiences. But from the standpoint of simplicity here in the explanation, if we have sensed and we have data that other people would reasonably expect us to be able to achieve this goal, and even though we think there's a reasonable chance that we could, we also believe that there's a chance that we couldn't. And if we don't, if we attempt to do so and we fail, that we may stand to lose a great deal of status as a result of that, then now this becomes not just the expenditure of the time and energy is lost if we fail, but also an additional price tag of a social loss has also been incurred. So as a result, the ego trap now springs its head. Now, if we say to ourselves, well, gee, the ego trap is such a miserable, self-destructive, you know, essentially piece of work, what if I avoid that by just bringing my expectations down and make them lower? The problem is that lower expectations, you don't get to select the goals that you go for. If your expectations are quote, low, then you're bored. You have no motivation at all. You already know that you can achieve this. In fact, it doesn't represent any improvement over the situation that you're in. Okay? So that would be like being excited about buying an investment house where you already know that you're paying full price and there's no particular upside. Why would there be any excitement? Why would there be any sense of urgency? Why would we be excited about a date with someone that we don't find particularly attractive and we don't think is any particularly good genetic deal? We wouldn't. Okay? So therefore, the answer to the question is you don't get to choose your expectations. Your expectations are what they are. And your excitement in this life is only driven by situations where there's a lot to gain and therefore there's excitement and high expectations. Sometimes excitement doesn't result in high expectations for your performance, like getting a deal on a house. But for very many things where the ego trap is ever involved, then it does involve this. And so the ego trap is an instinctual check. It's basically a very sophisticated piece of social psychological engineering inside of the human instinctual system to basically say, okay, well, be careful. Be careful because even though you very well may succeed, you may very well may fail, and even though it would represent a substantial increase in your survival and reproductive chips, you may incur a substantial loss. So this is why, for example, a lot of athletes do not have a killer instinct. They have a different psychology. They're a little bit different psychologically, so they don't want to take the risk. They could absolutely be ego-trapped in a situation. An awful lot of players, for example, do not want to be holding the ball in the last second and be fouled, okay, and then have to go to the free throw line and win the game from the free throw line. They would like to not have to shoot those free throws because we're, quote, supposed to make those free throws, and if we miss them and we lose the big game, you know, we are way more the GOAT. Okay, so that's the explanation to what is in fact a very good question.
Well, thank you, Dr. Lau. So, I've heard that in some cultures, it's a big deal to help people save face in the face of these types of things.
Sure.
How do you relate the quote "saving face" and ego trap?
There's a saving face. I mean, we'd have to break that down. We know what we're talking about, which is, in other words, trying to signal to people that they have not lost that much status. Okay, so this is again a component of human psychology where we are aware that someone is doing something or has done something that has cost them status. We may feel for them empathically. We may actually have our own status connected with them somehow, possibly. So as a result, we have an instinct that may attempt to mitigate their pain because of empathic mechanisms, or also to mitigate their loss so as to reduce our own. So that would be a component of the, quote, saving face process.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Do you want to do one more question that kind of fits into this, or call it an evening?
No, I think that's good. I think that's enough for one night. So we'll retool next week and add our co-pilot, Dr. Hawk, and we'll have at it again.
Wonderful. Dr. Lau, thank you so much for being here and answering the questions. We're really glad that you pressed the record button this time.
Yes. All good.
we'll talk to you next week.
All right. Fantastic, Nathan. We'll see you then.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.